This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Peter Crimmins in for Terry Gross. Being exposed to car bombs and IEDs of every sort was a way of life for our first guest, Brian Kastner. He was the commander of an EOD unit in Iraq. EOD stands for Explosive Ordnance Disposal. His unit's mission was to clear roads, cities, and buildings of IEDs. Those are improvised explosive devices. Find and blow weapons caches squirreled away through the country, and collect evidence from blast scenes to track down and kill the bomb makers. He had robots to defuse IEDs, but when the robots couldn't get the job done, one of the men had to put on an 80-pound protective Kevlar suit and do the long walk to the bomb, the real version of what was depicted in the film The Hurt Locker. Kastner's new memoir is called The Long Walk. It's about his experiences in Iraq, the after effects of being exposed to constant stress, life-threatening risk, and hundreds of explosions. Among the things he's dealing with is traumatic brain injury. Kastner was an officer in the U.S. Air Force from December 1999 to September 2007, and he says his memoir is as correct as it can be from someone with blast-induced memory lapses. Terry spoke with Kastner last week.
Brian Kastner, welcome to Fresh Air. So give us an overview of what your job was as a member of the Explosive Ordnance Disposal Unit, the EOD.
Sure. So all four services, Army, Navy, Air Force, Marine Corps, we all go to the same school and we all get the same basic skills. And so we're pretty much interchangeable when it comes to a war like Iraq or Afghanistan. So I was in the Air Force, but I was supporting the 101st Airborne Division, for example, in Kirkuk. And we would disassemble the IEDs when somebody else found them. We would go on route clearance patrols with the engineers, which is just driving the main highways, looking for IEDs and trying to get shot at, essentially, to trip the ambush before they would hit our convoys. Hopefully, we would find weapons caches and dispose of a lot of this bulk ordnance before it even made it out to be used as an IED. But Saddam Hussein and the Iraqi government bought so much ordnance over the years, there was just always more. There was no getting rid of all of the bombs.
A lot of our listeners will know about the work that you did through the movie The Hurt Locker, which I'm sure had some truth and fiction mixed together about the job. But, you know, the most dramatic thing in that film was when somebody had to put on, like, the suit, the 80-pound Kevlar suit, and do, you know, the long walk to the actual bomb and then try to disassemble the bomb before it exploded. Did you ever have to wear the suit and do the walk?
You know, I never did. And as an officer and in command of the unit, I went on lots and lots of missions, but it was definitely the team leader, the specialist who has done nothing but the technical aspect of the job for a decade. You know, it was his job to put on the suit. So I put guys in suits all the time, and I gave them the approval to put on the suit and go down nearly every day, every other day. And it is certainly the longest, loneliest walk that you will ever take. For an EOD guy who is used to being in control and accomplishing the mission, it is certainly more terrifying to be the one in the suit, but not having the sense of control to be able to do the one used to just, you know, drive me nuts to have to watch them walk down. And really, neither I nor anybody else can help them in that moment.
Did any of the men you work with actually get killed wearing the suit and doing the long walk to disassemble a bomb?
I was extremely lucky, so nobody under my direct command did while I was commanding them or while I was in charge. I have lost a lot of friends who were in the suit. I've lost a lot of friends who were not in the suit because they never had a chance to put it on because something blew them up that they didn't see. I consider myself extremely fortunate that I was never in the position of saying, yeah, it's time to put it on, and then to see them turn into that pink mist cloud.
What did you wear yourself?
When we got started in Iraq, guys were putting on all sorts of combinations of hillbilly armor, we called it. You bolted on metal plates to the side of your soft-skinned Humvee. And eventually the armor got so good. Guys are really surviving blasts that they never would have before. I just went down in May to the EOD Memorial. We have a memorial in Florida in Fort Walton Beach, and there's a wall set up where we put all of the names of the guys who died. And when you go to that ceremony, what strikes you is not just the number of names that we're putting on, which was 18 last year, which was the most since 1945, but then also that the other guys who are there attending, the number of people that have missing limbs, missing arms, missing legs, they probably would have died in previous wars, but the medical apparatus or infrastructure, I should say, that we have now is so good. People are losing multiple limbs, and they're coming home alive.
How many blasts would you say, approximately, that you were near in Iraq?
I have about 5 or 10 that I would say I was way too close. And then I have another couple dozen that were probably too close enough that they did a little bit of brain damage. And then on average, we would blow something up or something would blow us up about 2 or 3 times a day. So I guess the total number is it's in the hundreds. It's maybe 1,000.
Wow. So you always thought you were lucky for surviving. You had your limbs, nothing blown off, no blood, no wounds. But after you came home, you realized the kind of permanent damage that exposure, sometimes very close exposure, to all those blasts had really caused. What's your understanding now of how exposure to those explosions affects your brain?
So there's been a lot of new research that your brain is damaged by simply being close to an explosion. And there's really 2 kinds of brain damage when you think about traumatic brain injury, TBI, which is a bit of a buzzword now. Fortunately, people are becoming more aware of it. There's the concussion problem, which is what happens to football players and hockey players and boxers, and it happens to soldiers too. And that's when your brain comes to a sudden stop and smushes on the inside of your skull. And that happens in traffic accidents and such. But then there's a more insidious part, which is that explosive waves are a lot like sound waves. They're compression waves. And so when they travel through a medium, they speed up or slow down depending on how dense that medium is. So they move relatively slowly through the air, and then they speed up, say, through the wall, or they speed up through a car. They also speed up through your head. Anywhere that there's a change in density, there's going to be sheer ripping forces and tearing forces. And we always knew about these because that's what causes a lot of the deaths from suicide attacks or from terrorist attacks. Is there's a phenomenon called blast lung. And that's when the overwhelming blast tears all those little air pockets in your lungs and you essentially drown on your own blood. Well, all those forces that would have ripped all of that up also do the same thing in your brain. Every nerve ending and little fiber and little bump and nodule starts moving at a different speed as that blast wave moves through your head. And so you tear things internally. And if you go through a single traumatic event, if you step on a landmine or an IED and you lose your leg and that detonation is so close, you can have a single instantaneous traumatic event that does a lot of damage. But if you blow something up every day, it's more like occupational exposure. It's like playing guitar too loud in a band for years, except you're not just losing your hearing, you're losing short-term memories, you're losing long-term memories, you're losing the ability to make decisions, a lot of sleep disorders. There's just a lot of little insidious things, and it's a spectrum of problems, and I'm very lucky that I'm on one end, but all of my brothers in the EOD world, we all have some variety of this from having blown so many things up over the years.
What variety do you have?
I have sleep apnea. I have restless leg syndrome that I thought it was a fake disease. I thought it was something that people made up just to sell drugs and and sell pharmaceuticals on commercials, until I had some knee surgery and my legs started twitching, and I really felt it because every time my leg moved while I was sleeping, it would come up. I have a bunch of those. Maybe I have a couple of the memory and the hearing issues. The one that really bothered me, by and far the most problematic one, is the long-term memory loss. Is I've got some sections of when my kids were younger and when my wife and I met, and really the first three quarters of my marriage, that I just, you know, my wife says, "Do you remember that third birthday party?" No, I simply don't. And in fact, I don't remember months on either side of it either.
So when you got the diagnosis of traumatic brain injury, was that helpful? Now you had a name to give to some of the problems you were experiencing. Of course, it's a very frightening name. So what are the ways in which it was helpful or not helpful to have a name to give to what you were experiencing, a name that said that your brain was injured in ways that you did not yet understand?
It was extremely helpful. I felt like I had all of these non-specific issues relating to the long-term memory, related to some of my hearing issues or sleeping issues or whatever. And I thought I was making it up. And my wife and I would get into so many fights about, oh, you're purposely forgetting that. Oh, we talked about this. Don't you remember doing that? It just caused a lot of friction in our household on top of all of the other things we were dealing with. You're absolutely right. Having a name helps a lot.
Before you went to Iraq, you wrote a letter to your sons in case you didn't make it home. And you say that that letter is in a safe in your home. You haven't read it since you've gotten back, and you don't even remember what you wrote. So I guess I'm wondering why you kept it, and yet why you haven't read it.
You know, as a bomb tech, you don't spend a lot of your life being scared, but I'm scared to read that letter. I don't want to read it because I don't know what I put in, and I'm afraid that it's going to just be full of bravado and flag and country, and this is my great purpose, and a lot of the things that I felt that just don't make a lot of sense anymore. I kept it because it is honestly who I was. And either when my sons are older or after I'm gone, it'll give some insight, I suppose. I feel like I can't throw it out unless I read it first. And since I'm too scared to read it, it's still sitting there.
It was your job in Iraq to help disassemble bombs and to go to the site of IED explosions and collect whatever evidence you could. You need nerves of steel to do that kind of work. But when you came home and reentered civilian life, eventually all of that caught up with you, and those nerves of steel started to get really anxious and jangly and crazy. And it was, you know, you've had a very difficult period. And I guess I'm wondering about that transition from having to be calm in the face of, you know, mortal danger every day to coming home where you're actually safe and finding yourself a nervous wreck.
The stakes were all too low suddenly. And, you know, whether I did the dishes or not didn't seem to rise to the challenge of what I had done before. And when nothing is important anymore, I guess everything's important, or little things start to become too important. You get obsessive over the details. And that obsessive part of my brain that kept me alive in Iraq went into overdrive, and it became the hindrance. It became it's what got in the way. And so the book is really the edited scribblings of that overactive mind, I guess. And what I really needed was a way not to put myself in danger to feel better. What I really needed was a way to get back into the calmness of mind I had in Iraq. And so I found ways to do that. Running helped do that. Yoga helped do that. It helps make me present and gives me a lot of that mental clarity that you get when you're being shot at. You know, nothing brings you to the present like being shot at. And I missed that. And I didn't have that walking the dog. But I have enough of that in yoga, and it's a more healthy outlet, certainly.
And this is a yoga that combines meditation.
A little bit. I prefer vinyasa yoga because when you're moving so much and concentrating so much on your various positions of your body, you don't have the space to think about where your rifle is.
Right. How are you feeling now? I don't mean right this second, but I mean, you know.
I've put things in a better place, but it's never gone. My psychologist had an excellent analogy for it. She says it's like your shadow. Your shadow is always there if you look for it, but you don't always have to look at it. And really what I was doing was staring at my shadow constantly and waiting for it to go away. And it, of course, it's never going to. So I've learned not to look at my shadow, but we talked a little bit before about funerals. The funeral is where I remember that the shadow is still there.
Well, Brian Kastner, I want to thank you doubly. Thank you for this interview and for all you've told us. Thank you for your service to the country. Thank you very much.
Thank you. It's been an honor to speak to you.
Brian Kastner speaking with Terry Gross. Kastner's new memoir is called The Long Walk, A Story of War and the Life That Follows. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org.
This land is your land, and this land is my land.
Woody Guthrie had an enormous impact on American music. His songs and talking blues about the people displaced by the dust storms of the 30s, migrant workers, unions, the disparity between rich and poor, and the beauty of our country influenced Pete Seeger and the entire folk music revival. You can hear Guthrie's influence in early Bob Dylan songs. To celebrate Guthrie's centennial, Terry spoke with Ed Cray, author of the 2004 biography Ramblin' Man, and Jeff Place, who co-produced the new 3-CD box set Woody at 100. Place is the archivist for the Folklife Archives and Collections at the Smithsonian Center for Folklife and Cultural Heritage. The version of This Land Is Your Land that we've been listening to from the new box set was recorded in 1944, but that version was shelved until it was released decades later by the Smithsonian. The version most people know omits this verse about private property.
There was a big high wall there that tried to stop me. The sign was painted, said private property. But on the back side, it didn't say nothing. This land was made for you and me. When the sun comes shining, then I was strolling, and the wheat fields waving, and the dust clouds rolling. A voice was chanting as the fog was lifting. This land was made for you and me. This land is your land, and this land is my land. California to the New York Island, from Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me.
That's Woody Guthrie singing This Land Is Your Land, recorded in 1944. Jeff Place, Ed Cray, welcome to Fresh Air. I think it's fair to say lots of people know this song, but they don't necessarily know the version that we just heard. What is the story behind the version that we just heard?
Well, the story on that is when Woody Guthrie was traveling around, you know, post-Depression, he kept hearing Kate Smith singing God Bless America everywhere. And he listened to the lyrics and thought it really didn't address his people, the Okies, the disenfranchised, the Arkies, and what was happening in their world. So as a sort of a response to Kate Smith's song, he wrote a song called God Blessed America for You and Me in 1940. And it morphed a bit and changed, but the original version had a couple verses that we don't normally associate with that song, including one we just heard, which mentions, you know, a sign that said private property. The other side didn't say nothing. That side belonged to you and me. What happened was in the late, because Moses Ash is putting out a children's record in the late 40s, Woody re-recorded the thing as the version everybody knows without those two verses in it. So that's what everybody kind of ended up knowing over the years. And that became the version of This Land Is Your Land we all know.
So let's talk about why you're both so interested in Woody Guthrie. Jeff, let's start with you. You've just put out this new centennial box set of Woody Guthrie recordings with, a book of essays, including an extended essay by you. What do you see as Woody Guthrie's importance in American music?
I was one of those kids who grew up, in the 60s, hearing him, my parents playing him and stuff. And when I started working at the Smithsonian 25 years ago, I started working with his actual materials, his lyric sheets and the actual audio and digitizing it. And, it's just the more I listened, the more I was impressed. The amount of stuff that he had created and how good it was. I think that, because, Pete Seeger and others, popularizing Woody, he became sort of the image of what later on people like Bob Dylan and, singer-songwriters, kind of that great forefather of that kind of sound. After like Woody and the people who came along following him, like Dylan up to this day, the idea of writing your own songs on, guitar and singing them, about things you cared about is something that we kind of all know and expect. It's not, it's there now. And Woody, I think, was one of the first people really, to do that and became an important figure because of that.
Why don't we play another song here? And this is Pastures of Plenty, which I know is a favorite for both of you. And this is about migrant workers in California. Jeff, tell us what the song is actually about.
Pastures of Plenty was one of the things he wrote when he was hired actually by the federal government for,
30 days.
It's 30 days, there we go. To write songs that were going to go along with a movie they were making to sort of, I don't want to say propaganda, but it was to sort of get people to support, building dams on the Columbia River to create, hydroelectric power, and it would create jobs for some of the people Woody would care about. And among the songs he wrote, he apparently wrote like a song a day during the course of the month. Some of his best songs, Grand Coulee Dam, but Pastures of Plenty has always been one of my favorite. I just really like the imagery, but it was about some of the people he saw up in the Pacific Northwest, some of the migrants, and used an old folk song, Pretty Polly, with a beautiful melody, and put these it's like really great Woody Guthrie prose. It's like some of the, some of my favorite of the stuff he's written.
Okay, so let's hear Pastures of Plenty. And this version is on the new box set, Woody at 100 in celebration of his centennial. So here's Pastures of Plenty.
It's a mighty hard road that my poor hand is holding. My poor feet has traveled a hot, dusty road. Out of your dust bowl and westward we rolled, and your desert was hot and your mountains was cold. I worked in your orchards of peaches and prunes, slept on the ground in the light of your moon. On the edge of your city you've seen us, and then we come with the dust and we go with the wind. California and Arizona, I make all your crops, and it's north up to Oregon to gather your hops. Dig the beets from your ground, cut the grapes from your vine, to set on your table your light sparkling wine. Green pastures of plenty from dry desert ground, from that Grand Coulee Dam where the water runs down. ever stayed in this Union. Us migrants have been. We'll work in this fight, and we'll fight till we win. Well, it's always we ramble, that river and I, all along your green valley. I'll work till I die. My land I'll defend with my life if it be, 'cause my pastures of plenty must always be free.
That's Pastures of Plenty, and that version is on the new box set, Woody at 100, in celebration of the centennial. My guest, Jeff Place, co-produced the box set, co-wrote the book that accompanies it. Also with us is Ed Cray. His biography of Woody Guthrie, Ramblin' Man, has just been published in a new paperback edition. One of the things Woody Guthrie is famous for is his children's songs, which have endured. So people love his children's songs. How was he as a father? How was he as a family man?
He was. It depended on what family you were talking about. His eternal love was his second wife, Marjorie. There's no question about that. And the children that they produced together. Kathy, unfortunately, died in a fire. Kathy, then Arlo, Jody, and after Tom Joad, and Nora, after Woody's mother. He was a devoted family man there. But even there, there was friction. He would wander off, go for cigarettes and not return for 2 weeks. All kinds of problems in the marriage, yes. And Woody, and they ultimately divorced. So in that sense, you can argue Woody was a terrible family man, irresponsible, etc. On the other hand, he was devoted to those children. And in fact, the children's songs, starting with Kathy, were all written for his children.
And Arlo, who you mentioned, of course, went on to become a famous folk singer himself. And Nora is running the Woody Guthrie papers and music archive and doing a lot of work to get younger generations of musicians to record his songs. And she's been putting out lyrics that didn't have melodies and asking, you know, songwriters to write melodies to accompany those lyrics. So she's been very active in furthering her father's legacy.
Well, she's been the one person out there over the last 20 years who's, you know, kind of, you know, helping, like, sort of encourage people to do, like you say, recordings of some of his lyrics, but also people to write books, all sorts of projects with people, you know, over the years, just making sure that almost every year, this year especially because of the centennial, but there's some sort of Woody Guthrie project out there. So Woody's name is just sort of, you know, just out there for people not to forget. You know, Nora's been really, you know, consciously doing that.
Okay. Thank you both so much.
Thank you, Terry.
You're very welcome.
Terry spoke with Ed Cray and Jeff Place last week. Cray's 2004 biography of Guthrie called Ramblin' Man has been published in a new edition. Jeff Place co-produced the new 3-CD box set Woody at 100. Coming up, writer-director Kenneth Lonergan talks about his film Margaret, whose theatrical release was delayed after almost 6 years. It's out now on DVD. This is Fresh Air Weekend.
Thousands of folk back east, they say, leaving home every day, beating a hot and dusty way to the California line. Across the desert sand they roll, trying to get out of the old dust bowl. They think they're coming to a sugar bowl. Here's what they find. The police at the port of entry say, you're number 14,000 for today. Oh, if you ain't got the do-re-mi, folks, you ain't got the do-re-mi. Better hang on in beautiful Texas, Oklahoma, Kansas, Georgia, Tennessee. California is a garden of Eden, a paradise to live in or see. But believe it or not, you won't find it so hot if you ain't got the do-re-mi.
This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Peter Crimmins, in for Terry Gross. Sometimes you read about a great movie, but it's never going to come to your neighborhood. One recent film, described in The New Yorker as nothing short of a masterwork, not only didn't make it into many theaters, it almost didn't get released at all. The movie is called Margaret. It was completed in 2006, but because of lawsuits regarding the length of the final edit and other complications, it wasn't released until last year, and few people saw it. But now it's been released to DVD in two versions, the theatrical release and an extended cut. Our next guest is the film's director and writer, Kenneth Lonergan, who also wrote and directed the film You Can Count on Me and is the author of several plays. The lawsuits have not yet been resolved, so that's one thing Terry and Lonergan could not discuss when they spoke last week. Margaret is set in a post-9/11 New York. It's about a teenager, Lisa Cohen, played by Anna Paquin. She's a bright, passionate, but argumentative student in an Upper West Side private school. She's going through the adolescent struggles of fighting with her mother and experimenting with her newfound sexuality. In this scene, near the beginning of the movie, Lisa's flirtatiousness with a bus driver leads to an accident in which the bus runs a red light and hits a woman. The accident changes the course of the teenager's life. Horrified and guilt-stricken, Lisa kneels over the woman, played by Allison Janney, to comfort her. A shocked crowd surrounds them, trying to help.
Call an ambulance. Everybody just step back.
I'm calling one right now.
Get an ambulance.
Someone's calling one.
Ma'am, can you hear me? Can you hear me?
I don't know. Where am I?
You're on Broadway and 75th Street.
Broadway between 75th and 74th Street.
Who are you?
My name is Lisa.
What do you mean?
Am I dead?
No, you're not dead. You're in a traffic accident, but you're going to be okay.
I don't have a direct address. She's out in the street.
What do you mean? What happened?
You were run over by a bus.
You got to be kidding me. A bus?
Yeah.
Is there a doctor?
So where am I now?
An ambulance is on its
still
way.
Happening?
No, I mean, yes, the accident's over. I think you're a little confused.
I'll say I'm confused.
Here, let me try to see if
no!
I
can.
That's a scene from Kenneth Lonergan's film, Margaret. Kenneth Lonergan, welcome to Fresh Air. It's great to have you here. I love your movie. You know, this is an amazing scene to me because it's so horrifying. And at the same time, the Allison Janney character, the woman hit by the bus, is so New York. It's like she is dying and she's being such the consummate New Yorker. Like, you got to be kidding me, a bus? I think the writing in this scene is really amazing. Would you just talk about that a little bit, about keeping her in that really kind of like aggressive New York character, even when she's totally disoriented and dying?
Well, my sister-in-law is a doctor. After having written the script and the scene, I asked her whether it was credible. I said, would the person be in shock? Would they be unconscious? Would they be awake? Would they be in terrible pain? And she said it could be anything in those circumstances. There was no limit to the variety of reactions that a human being can have when they've been subjected to that violent a trauma. And as far as Allison's character, she's an extraordinary actress. I've known her for a long time. And she played the scene beautifully and with that kind of verve and anguish without needing much direction. I mean, she just lay there all day on the cement and then dying and complaining and then we would cut and she'd just smile and look up at me and say, how is that? And I have photographs of her drenched in blood smiling up at me while I'm bending over her with my headphones on. And it was kind of an extraordinary day because Anna and Allison were so intense and the wall of extras around them were so affected by their performances that it drew them in beautifully.
So I have to say that this scene so early in the movie completely drew me into your film, in part because it's such a gripping scene and it's almost like a horror movie, like her bloody hand keeps coming into the frame and it's so frightening.
That single incident drives the entire film and drives the entire journey of Anna Paquin's character. And it's a long film in both versions. And I knew that if that accident wasn't extremely awful, I mean, just as awful as humanly possible, then there'd be no movie because it's never referred. You don't see any flashbacks of it. It's got to stay in your mind the way it stays in the character's mind.
So the main character, Anna Paquin, who's a high school student, she's there by the dying woman's side, but she's also kind of responsible for the accident because she's very flirtatious, she's very beautiful, and kind of knows that she is, and dresses, you know, like a little provocatively the way a lot of teenage girls do.
Mm-hmm.
And she, you know, just to set this up a little bit, she wants a cowboy hat because she's going on a trip with her father to, yeah. I don't know if it's a dude ranch, but they're going to be horseback riding. So she wants like right. the right look. And the bus driver's wearing, she can't find a hat like that in Manhattan. The bus driver's wearing one. So she kind of knocks on the door and runs after the bus, waving at him, trying to yeah. get his attention. And he's waving at her. And he just like sails through that red light.
Yeah.
And she knows that this death is partly her fault.
Yeah.
But she can't deal with it, so she wants him to take responsibility for it. But he denies that he went through a red light. He just says he didn't do anything wrong.
Yeah.
So I guess I'm interested in hearing why you wanted to write a film about how the consequences of this flirtatious action is going to totally change her life.
I wanted to do a story about someone who is the door opens to a much larger, more frightening, more difficult world, and how she deals with it, especially someone with a great lack of experience in worldly things. It's basically a story of someone who is well-trained in the life of high school and of teenagers and dealing with a whole slew of consequences of things that happen in the adult world, like death and the legal system and the great class differences that exist side by side in a city like New York. And as far as the flirtatiousness goes, that's an interesting part of the story to me, because she's just at that age where she finds that she has this power to interest men, and she's having a very good day. She successfully flirted with her teacher. Her friend asked her out, and she is dressing very provocatively, and she is flirting with this handsome bus driver, and she just has the bad luck that it ends in this hideous catastrophe.
It made me wonder, and you might not want to go there, but since we went to a school similar to the upper middle class private school in Manhattan, that part mm-hmm. of the movie is set in. It made me wonder about how you felt about the teenage girls in your school who were beautiful and, you know, flirtatious and often inappropriate in how they used their sexual power. Do you know?
Frustrated. I was saying I was very frustrated. I was very shy. I didn't have a girlfriend in high school. I felt envious of them in a way, because people were very attracted to them, and they did have this power, and I felt sort of powerless in that arena. And I went to a school exactly like the school in the film, which was an upper-middle-class school, not a super wealthy school. But there was one kid whose father was extremely wealthy, who had bought him a Porsche at 17. And I remember driving around with him in this Porsche, and everyone's head would turn to look at the car because it was so beautiful. I thought, oh, gee, this must be what it's like to be a pretty girl. So I think that's a kind of person that's remained interesting to me, not just from the normal male point of view, but just in terms of what it's like to be that person.
So those teenage feelings figured into your writing of the screenplay for Margaret?
Yes, I think so. I find that to be a fascinating age, because they seem half-formed and their opinions seem borrowed. And the basic structure of the movie is the first half is teenage land and the second half is grown-up land, and they're just very different. You don't form and break up incredibly close friendships within days in grown-up land, and things are just not as passionate nor as easy as they are when you're a teenager.
So I want to play another scene from the film. Lisa Cohen, the main character in the film, played by Anna Paquin, her parents are divorced. Her father lives in L.A. He's played by you.
Yes.
And her mother is played by your wife, J. Smith Cameron. And there's a scene I want to play. You know, the Anna Paquin character is at that age where she's constantly sarcastic with her mother, and not in a funny way, just in a kind of mean-spirited way. And her mother can't
angry.
Understand, like, why aren't they close anymore? Like, why can't she say anything without getting these, like, barbed retorts from her teenage daughter? So in this scene, the mother's about to go on a date with a man she's recently met. She hasn't dated in a really long time. She's dressed up, and she's asked her daughter if the dress makes her look fat. She's actually very insecure about all this, and her daughter says, just a little, which is only going to add to the insecurity. She does not look fat, by the way. And And so they're about to have this conversation about the date the mother's going on. And there's a lot of tension between them. So Anna Paquin speaks first.
Where are you going?
The opera.
Why are you going to the opera?
Turns out he's a really big opera fan. Anyway, don't you think it sounds kind of fun? We should all go sometime.
No thanks.
Why not? I bet you'd like it.
I don't like that kind of singing.
But you like classical music.
Yes, that's true, but I don't like opera singing.
But when have you
it's
ever...
like their entire reason for existing is to prove how loud they can be. I don't really find that all that interesting.
Yeah, I know what you mean. But it's not all like that. You like the magic flute.
Okay. I guess I'm wrong. I guess I do like opera singing. I just didn't realize it.
What is the matter with you?
Nothing at all. Why are you pushing this? I don't want to go to the opera.
Yes, okay. It's called an invitation. I'm not pushing anything. All you have to say is no thanks.
I did, and then you were like, why not? So then I told you, and then you started, like, debating me. Like, you assumed that I've never thought this through for myself, which I have many times.
Okay, well, that was a really contemptuous assumption on my part. I don't actually like the opera that much myself, but I'm trying to expand my mind. Maybe that's wrong. I'm sorry. I guess I'm a little nervous about you guys meeting Ramon.
Why? What's the big deal? Why are you so influenced by what Curtis and me... what Curtis and I think?
Hey, why does everything I say annoy you?
Jesus Christ, I'm just sitting here.
Here, you be me and say anything, and I'll respond to you the way you've been responding to me this whole conversation.
No.
Go ahead, you say something to me, and I'll say something to you.
No, I'm not going
to
do that.
Why not?
Because it's dumb and horrible. I get your point.
Okay. Whatever.
Is that supposed to be an imitation of me?
Okay, withdrawn.
That's Anna Paquin as the daughter and J. Smith Cameron as the mother in a scene from Margaret, a film written and directed by my guest, Kenneth Lonergan. I love that scene because one of the things it just shows is how a very bright teenager can use their intelligence in a really annoying way. in a really kind of show-offy, irritating, weapon-like way. And I'm sure you had a lot of friends who were like that when you were growing up and going to this, you know, elite private school.
Yeah, and I'm sure I was like that myself. You discover two things when you're a teenager. One is that your parents are not the idols that you thought they were when you were growing up, if you had nice parents, that is. If you didn't, you discover that much earlier. And two, that you have power over them, that you can upset them and confront them and attack them. And there's this combination of disappointment and judgment that teenagers frequently have, which is can be extremely savage to the parent. And it's part of splitting off and getting away from the parent and becoming a grown-up. But in this case, it's one thing that we talked about during the scene when we were rehearsing it and shooting it is that the girl is carrying this terrible secret about this accident that she's caused and is all alone with it. And I said to Anna, I said, you know, Anna, I think she's waiting and hoping her mother will guess what's wrong and ask her about it so she can talk about it. But she doesn't. And the mother misunderstands and thinks she's angry at her for having a new boyfriend. And that helplessness of how you talk to someone who's just being snotty to you, who you care about and you're trying to reach out to them, and also that frustration of being a teenager and being trapped in the situation and having this new negative view of your mother and using, as you say, the power of your brains and the position of closeness to constantly attack and make these idiotic fights that you have between teenagers and their parents. My daughter's not a teenager yet, but I have a large extended family and seen a lot of these arguments. They're awful because they're merciless.
The title of the film isn't the name of the main character. You know, the main character's name is Lisa. It's not Margaret. And it's not even the title of the poem that inspired the name of the title, Margaret. There's a poem by Gerard Manley Hopkins published in 1918, and posthumously he died in 1889. And the poem is called Spring and Fall to a Young Child, and Margaret is referred to within that poem. And this is a poem that Matthew Broderick, the English teacher in the Anna Paquin character's high school, is reading to the students. What does this poem mean to you? Is this a poem that you discovered on your own that has always meant a lot to you?
It's a poem that Matthew's mother, Patricia Broderick, who was a very close friend of mine and was my mentor essentially, for many years.
His mother was your mentor?
Yeah.
Was she a teacher?
No, she was many things. She was a brilliant painter and a very brilliant playwright and a director as well. And she was the smartest person I've ever met. And I always showed her everything that I wrote, from the first play that I happened to show her when I was in high school that I wrote to this movie, I think is the last thing of mine that she read before she passed away. I showed her everything to make sure, because I knew she would help me, and if there was something wrong with it, she would tell me, and she would be very accurate. Anyway, among many other things that she introduced me to some poetry, and this is one of the poems that she really liked and that meant a lot to her, and it's one of the three poems that I know by heart. So I was writing one of the scenes in English class, and the idea of putting the poem in struck me as right, and then as soon as I did that, I found that I hadn't titled the film yet. It was called Bus Film in my computer for many months, and then I knew it should be called Margaret because the poem is so appropriate to the situation that the girl finds herself in and that we all find ourselves in, which is this first shocking realization and sensitivity to death and things changing, which then, as the poem says, as the heart grows older, it will come to such sights colder by and by. And it just seemed so on the money for what was going on with Anna Paquin's character internally that it didn't seem like it was too much hammering it over the head to entitle the film Margaret.
Read the last two lines that has the name Margaret in it.
Sure. The first line is, Margaret, are you grieving over Golden Grove unleaving? Which is just wonderful, because when you're little and you see a dead bird or you see a lost dog, it eats you alive. And then when you're 30 and you see a dead bird or a lost dog, you just drive right by it and you don't care. And there's something about the sensitivity to death that a child has or an adolescent has that I think is ultimately more correct than the getting used to it all of an adult.
Kenneth Lonergan, it's been great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Well, it's been a real pleasure for me, too. I love your show, and this is a great honor to be on it.
Director and screenwriter Kenneth Lonergan speaking with Terry Gross. Lonergan's film Margaret is now out on DVD. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Kevin Griffin. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, Heidi Simon, Teresa Madden, and Yowei Shaw. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Melody Kramer is our associate producer for online media. For Terry Gross, I'm Peter Crimmins.